Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Obama administration has brought big changes to U.S.-Cuba relations, easing travel restrictions and thereby increasing the number of U.S. visitors and investment. But President-elect Donald Trump is less enamored with the island country and has said that President Obama traded too much for too little in his negotiations. That, on top of the recent death of iconic Cuban revolutionary leader Fidel Castro, leaves a future of U.S.-Cuban relations in something of a limbo. Joining us now is Cuban-American attorney based in Columbus, Luis Alcalde. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann.
Joining us by phone is Havana-based journalist Hannah Berkeley Cohen, whose coverage of Cuban life appears frequently in the New York Times. Welcome back, Hannah.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Hannah, a lot of change indeed. You contributed to a recent Times story about the age gap in how Cubans are responding to the death of Fidel Castro. What does age have to do with it?
I mean, I think age has everything to do with it. The older generation, people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, a lot of them consider themselves communists. They fought in the revolution. They remember what pre-Castro days in Cuba were like. And, you know, they feel like they benefited firsthand from the revolution. Now, their kids and their grandchildren, they know Fidel Castro more as, someone in the history books. They hear mentions of him, but they don't remember what life was like in the 70s and 80s when Cuba had its golden period before the special period and things, got really depressing here in Cuba. I think children, people in the youth generation, are a bit more apathetic. They don't feel like they experienced firsthand the benefits of the revolution, and I think for that reason they feel a bit of indifference. Whereas their grandparents remember what things were like before Castro, and they feel very thankful, and they recognize what the revolution brought them.
Luis Alcalde, as far as your work as a Cuban-American attorney, you're based in Columbus, but you do a lot of work in Cuba. You've been there 6 or 7 times this year alone. What does the death of Fidel Castro mean in terms of just the work you do? Does it really matter? Is it an emotional thing or what?
Yeah, I don't think that the death of Fidel Castro will mean a whole lot in terms of how Cuba is going to evolve or how U.S.-Cuba relationships are going to evolve. I think Fidel has been out of power now for a number of years, and I think Cuba is run by Raul, but also run by a council of ministers that represents a lot of competing interests and power centers in Cuba, and really the death is more psychological. I think that perhaps the more hardliners in the Cuban government that are less enamored with change may have lost sort of a symbolic leader. But other than that, I don't think it will have a lot of effect.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Hannah, what about an age gap? Does it exist in terms of the response by Cubans to the election of Donald Trump?
When I went out onto the streets right after Fidel Castro died, most of the people who were on the streets, is about 1:30 in the morning. There were a bunch of Cuban youth. They had just been asked to leave the nightclubs that they were in. The whole city shut down. When I asked them what the death of Fidel Castro means, also in light of the recent Trump election, again, a general sense of indifference. A lot of Cuban youth I spoke to, they say that any change is good change. They've been hearing promises of change since they were born in the late 80s and the early 90s. There are the Cuban millennials, and they're skeptical. They've been hearing foreign journalists come in asking them what they feel about all of these changes, and their sentiments are essentially, look, we'll believe it when we see it, but we haven't seen any change yet. So even if we don't, if we don't think Donald Trump may be the nicest person, if he's, said mean things, we don't really care because he might be the one to bring change to Cuba.
And older Cubans?
I think older Cubans are just a bit more skeptical about U.S. politicians in general, even with the overwhelming positive, response with Obama's trip here earlier this year. Older Cubans, you know, thought, well, maybe he's coming here with an agenda. Maybe this is kind of an imperialistic regime coming to take over again. So I would say the older generation in general is a bit more skeptical about any type of U.S. involvement, whereas the younger generation welcomes any type of involvement to change the current situation.
And Luis Alcalde, deal-making Cubans, people who are trying to change the economy in Cuba, the people you're working with, the business people there, what's your sense about how they're reacting to the election results?
Well, I think that there's a lot of concern that a lot of the advances that have been made are going to be stalled, and that the U.S. is going to go back to the policies, perhaps not 100% prior to Obama's opening in 2014, but that there's going to be a regression, let's say. And, you know, my sense is that pressuring the Cubans, I'm talking about the Cuban government, pressuring the Cuban government in a very public manner and making a lot of demands about changes is going to be counterproductive.
That's not how they operate.
No. They, Cubans, particularly the older generation of Cubans, as Hannah is alluding to, you know, which are the ones that are in power, obviously, are very nationalistic. And I think that they will react in a very nationalistic way. And even within the Cuban government, there are different, thoughts as to how to move forward. You know, what kind of changes to make, how far to liberalize the economy. They'll have these internal arguments with them, and they're having them under the Obama administration. But my fear is that an attempt to force him to do something will simply become a nationalistic response on behalf of the Cubans.
Hannah Berkeley Cohen, what do you make of that?
I think that makes all the sense in the world. I mean, what Donald Trump is threatening to do, and again, I will reiterate, you know, Cubans, whether they're old or young, are very skeptical about Donald Trump. They are not interested in, sensationalizing what he's saying on Twitter. So, you know, one day he says he's going to, he's threatening to go back to Bush-era policy as far as Cuba is concerned. Mm-hmm. And then the next day he says, you know, we're interested in making these big deals. So I think right now in Cuba, people are waiting to see what happens. There's a general consensus that he's a bully, that he may not be the kindest leader. You know, this is in light of Obama's visit, and he was very, very well received here in Cuba. People were overwhelmingly excited and happy about his visit. I think there's a sense of skepticism here, both in the older and younger generation, and people. You know, what they don't want to see is, here in Cuba, people don't want to see the Cuban Adjustment Act lifted, but they are interested in seeing an end to the embargo. And, you know, they see Trump as a businessman, and they think that maybe it is in his best interest to lift the embargo.
What's the Cuban Adjustment Act?
So essentially Cubans, it's informally known as the wet foot, dry foot policy. They, it's put into place in the Clinton administration. Cubans can arrive to the U.S. They can present themselves at either the Mexican U.S. border or the Canadian border, or what many Cubans have taken to doing is making rafts, many of them dying in the Florida Straits along the way, and arriving in Cuba. If you remember Elian Gonzalez in the 90s, he was right. The famous poster child of wet foot, dry foot policy. So many Cubans right now are fleeing in record numbers, thinking, well, if Trump is interested in with Congress lifting the embargo, then that might also mean an end to this wet foot, dry foot policy and an end to special privileges for Cubans arriving in the U.S. Right now, Cubans are one of the only people who are able to arrive to the U.S. They can claim political asylum and receive cash assistance, job placement assistance, food stamps, Medicare. They have special privileges that many immigrants around the world are very envious of.
And the expectation is once relations are normalized between the United States and Cuba, there's no reason for that anymore.
Absolutely. Right. And, I mean, a lot of the Cuban youth I spoke to said, you know, despite Trump's, personal agenda, since he is a businessman, he might be interested in lifting the embargo, but a lot of them see the lifting of the embargo going hand in hand with the lifting of the Cuban Adjustment Act.
So, you know, Hannah, you've been on a few times before since 2014 when President Obama first announced that they were going to pursue and that they had been pursuing these change of relations with Cuba. What can you tell us has been the most obvious reflections of that in Cuban society?
I mean, overall, I think the skepticism, especially amongst the youth generation, as far as American tourists are concerned, has diminished. Even in the summer months where tourism is usually, on a low season.
Because it's so hot.
Swarms of American tourists, you know, hotels are totally booked. There have been several instances where hotels have double booked everyone in the hotel and are asking for double the price in cash. There are hardly any rental cars. There still isn't traffic yet in Havana. I know a lot of the Cubans are worried that with the influx of tourists, there'll be more traffic jams. But, you know, basically all of the paladars or privately owned restaurants are filled up, places where you used to be able to kind of casually walk in. You now have to make a reservation days in advance. And, you know, Cubans are seeing more and more average American tourists. It used to be that, it was a headache and a lot of paperwork to get to Cuba. Cubans saw a lot of very socially active, I would argue majorly left-leaning kind of socialist self-identifying American tourists. Now, you see a lot of average American tourists. They're coming on the new cruise ship. There's a Carnival cruise ship that's docking in the Havana Bay. You're seeing, bachelor parties. You're seeing groups of people almost spring breaker type.
Huh.
So you're getting a lot more of not necessarily intellectual tourism, but just kind of average American tourists who are interested in a Caribbean getaway.
Huh. Lewis?
Yeah, and I think everything that Hannah has said is totally on, and I've witnessed all of it, but On a bigger scale, for example, I think that some of the biggest changes I have seen is that, and this is something that doesn't get a lot of publicity, the U.S. government and the Cuban government have been engaged in a number of negotiations involving the environment, drug interdiction, immigration policies, which are not getting a lot of press, but there's a lot of progress being made in lowering barriers and creating more cooperation between both governments.
Since 2014.
Since 2014. And in addition to that, for example, I'm working in a biopharma project, and I'm talking to scientists in Cuba. I'm seeing a lot of Cuban scientists being able to come to the United States and interact with American scientists that wasn't happening before. A lot more American scientists going to Cuba. We signed a healthcare memorandum between our Department of Health and the Cuban Health Ministry. There's a lot more cooperation going on between both governments in a lot of areas, very significant areas, that goes way beyond tourism.
And this is all hinges on this ongoing normalization of relations between the two countries.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Hannah Berkley-Cohen, thank you for joining us. Always appreciate your insights there in Havana, Cuba.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Take care. We will continue our conversation coming up. Former British ambassador to Cuba will be joining us and give us his insights. And still with us, Lewis Alcalde, Cuban-American attorney based here in Columbus. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Normalization of U.S. diplomatic relations with Cuba was sure to be a major legacy of the Obama administration. But President Obama's efforts were executive in nature and therefore vulnerable to the next president, who happens to disagree with the whole idea, apparently. Here's what Donald Trump said on the campaign trail in September.
All of the concessions that Barack Obama has granted the Castro regime were done through executive order, which means the next president can reverse them. And that I will do unless the Castro regime meets our demands.
That last word was demands. And he said, we're talking about the future of U.S.-Cuban relations. Still with us is Columbus-based Cuban-American attorney Luis Alcalde. And joining us by phone is former British ambassador to Cuba and senior lecturer in international relations at Boston University, Paul Webster Hare. Welcome to the show, Ambassador Hare.
Thank you.
Ambassador, does the apparent Trump administration posture pose opportunities for other countries?
Well, the first question is, of course, how far he will follow through on that, how far it's practicable. Certainly, I think legally he could do it, but in my view, it sits rather oddly with some of his other statements about putting America first, not sticking American noses into the affairs of other countries, and really concentrating on America at home. At the moment, of course, many Cuban Americans are traveling back and forth totally freely. They're investing in small businesses of their families. They're sending billions of dollars in remittances. So to change some of that would have a big effect. It might have a big effect on Cuba, but it'd also have a big effect on many American citizens.
Right. You know, critics have complained that President Obama gave too much to the Cubans too soon without first demanding a more open society and more political freedom. But much has also been written about Donald Trump's comfort level with authoritarian regimes. And I'm wondering, is that what he's complaining about, or is he talking about dollars and cents type of deal things?
Well, I don't think anybody knows.
Right.
He has not studied many international issues, I think, very profoundly. Why would he? I mean, he probably didn't contemplate coming this far. And the Cuba issue is, of course, mighty complicated. It has, of course, a 57-year history. And many U.S. presidents and secretaries of state and so on have grappled with it. So he will have to work out what he does. It's a good point you make about leaving Cuban business open to the likes of Russia, China, and of course Venezuela is declining, but is he going to say to the American people, well, sorry, they're going to build the golf courses and the hotels there, which of course is his own line of business.
Exactly.
And we'll stay away for these high-minded human rights religious principles which he's mentioned. The policy of President Obama, and of course he's proud of it, he wrote a long memorandum just in October, which is very interesting to read, was not that he approves of everything that goes on the island, but he feels that change can be brought through more engagement, and that, you know, accords largely with what the EU, my own country, the UK, has tried to do as well in Cuba.
It reminds me more of sort of a Nixonian approach to dealing with a government like Cuba.
Yes, that's perhaps right. Yes, I mean, you recognize there are issues where you can engage on. I think we heard of some of the environmental issues just before I came on. There are many others, disaster relief, education exchanges. We used to do a lot in sport with the Cubans, in music, in science. And you can engage on those. They're very well-educated people. They're looking for more openness. They're looking for more opportunities to engage internationally. And the biggest change agents that the United States are bringing are the Cuban Americans. They are bringing information. They're bringing resources. They're bringing material benefits, and Cubans are visiting them in the United States. So the information blockade that the Cuban government's exerted for many years is being breached, has been breached, and that's very important.
Right. You've called the Cuban-American community about roughly 2 million, I think, at this point, a hidden asset for the United States.
Well, it's an asset. It's not that hidden because they are, you know, flocking there in hundreds of thousands. And the tourism figures, which are quoted, generally exclude those. So it's highly likely that the more U.S. citizens are visiting Cuba than from any other country at the moment, if you include the Cuban Americans. I would think they've overtaken Canada, but the statistics are not given out in that way. So, yes, I mean, it's something that's really happening under the radar of both governments. The Cuban Americans go down. They bring a lot of the money in cash. They bring material goods for the small restaurants, for the manicure shops that they do up the taxes. And, you know, a lot of that is not recorded in any governmental statistics. But what it is doing is breaking up and loosening the fabric of Cuban society. Cubans are learning how to run small businesses. They're learning how to network with other Cubans. They're earning a lot more money. And again, that is, if you believe in economic reform, you believe in greater openness, that is good. And really, it's only the United States that can do that. As you say, it's close to 2 million, and many of those are visiting.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from former British ambassador to Cuba, Paul Webster Hare. He was there from 2001 to 2004, and now a lecturer at Boston University. Also with us, Luis Alcalde, Cuban-American attorney based in Columbus, spends a lot of time in Cuba working on business deals. Luis, does what Ambassador Hare says, is that resonating with you? Makes
oh,
sense?
Yeah. I mean, the ambassador is 100% right on. I'm deep in the weeds of doing projects with Cubans in Cuban biotechnology, and we're having conversations about venture capital. We're having conversations about what American investors expect about an investment, what the expectations are in terms of return, what contracts should look like in a normal, you know, sort of capitalist pharmaceutical deal. And these things were not occurring, you know, prior to Obama. And you know, there's absolutely no way that this is not creating unbelievable change with people in Cuba in very important positions. And so to go back to a policy where we're not doing that is, to me, would be folly.
And Ambassador Hare, you served for 3 years, as I said, until 2004 in Cuba. What did you make of the Obama administration's efforts to normalize relations when he announced it in late 2014?
Well, I thought it would have happened earlier, to be honest, and I think it would have done without the imprisonment of Alan Gross, if you remember the American citizen who was held for, I think, 4 or 5 years it was in the end for engaging in that rather strange aid operation. And I think the timing became critical once Hugo Chavez in Venezuela died, which was in March 2013. So that was when the negotiations really got a kick start. And, you know, I think if you read what Obama's said recently, and what he did way back in 2009 when he largely freed up the remittances and the travel, he became committed to the Cuba issue, and he wanted to bite the bullet and make the change, not because he approved of Castro regimes and, you know, the restrictions on freedom, the media and so on, but because he thought that the existing policy had failed. And if you look at polling, which has been done very recently again, amongst Cuban Americans, they overwhelmingly agree that the embargo has failed and the policy of regime change didn't work. That's, you know, unarguable that that's correct. So I think, you know, there's a lot of logic in it. It's going not to produce instantaneous results. And I think it's not reasonable to expect the Cubans will approve a lot of big U.S. projects, even if the embargo were listed. They don't approve big British projects or big Japanese projects. They are very wary about foreign investment still. And that's one of the issues the revolution has to deal with.
They're very wary on what basis? Cultural change, changing what they're about, or they don't trust the business people from other countries?
Yes. I mean, the narrative of the revolution is really that there should be equality amongst Cubans. Now, that has changed a bit. Raul has offered a slightly different narrative. But unfortunately, it seems strange. The objective of the revolution is to preserve the revolution of socialism, which is equality, free public services, not conspicuous wealth, not the Chinese model of materialism and consumerism and so on. And that was what Fidel stood for. He detested what the Chinese have done. So if you bring in foreign investment, you're giving jobs to some Cubans and not others. The foreign investors try to pay them much more, just as we used to pay Cubans in the embassy a lot more than $25 a month, because they're talented and nobody can live off that. But then that breaks up the fabric of socialism, and that's what the revolution and their control fears.
Luis Alcalde, how much does that aspect of this come into play in making deals and doing work that you do in Cuba?
Yeah, I think that the ambassador is correct in that the Cubans are moving very cautiously because they realize that the way that they're liberalizing the economy, of course, is somewhat disruptive to how the system has worked in the past. However, they also realize that the system hasn't worked and that they need foreign investment. And in my opinion, you know, Cuba very much wants foreign investment. They are moving slow for a number of reasons. You know, my own personal experience is that the Cubans, to some extent, are learning how to make deals, big deals with foreign investors. You know, I've actually been in meetings where I have had discussions in Cuba about how we expect our investors to react to things, right? And the Cubans are arguing with me, and they're looking at literature from 2002, for example, articles on how venture capitalists may have been thinking in 2002 about certain issues. And, you know, and as soon as we find out what their mindset is, we tell them, well, you know, it's 2016. You know, a lot has happened. You know, we had the 2008 economic crisis and things like that. So part of the slowdown is, I think, this being very careful because it's going to be disruptive to Cuban society. But the other part is, I think that they're learning and trying to figure out how to make a good deal for Cuba.
Ambassador, when the president announced in 2014 that he would pursue this normalization, we understood at that time, and it's come to pass, that it's been through executive order, which has made it vulnerable to the next administration. When he did this, when he was announcing this, given your experience, were you expecting that there could be problems down the road because of how he was doing it?
Obviously, it was always possible that it would be reversible. I think what he's tried to do in the 2 years since then is to build up the momentum to such an extent that it won't be reversible. Now, there haven't been a lot of big American deals signed. I mean, because of partly, of course, because they can't bid for a lot of the projects. I think the Chinese got a deal to refurbish the airport. The Chinese are putting in the fiber optic cables for broadband internet. But quite a few things have resulted from the deal. I mean, you now have Starwood's Hotels going in to take over the management of a hotel in Havana, and other hotel chains are looking at tourism businesses. But the Cubans are, yes, on paper, I agree with Dr. Alcalde, I agree that they are on paper wanting foreign investment projects, and they had a new law in 2014. But the bureaucracy and, the need to get innumerable approvals often put people off. And they've had foreign investment since the mid-90s. We had quite a lot of British companies. In fact, the main hotel, the luxury hotel in Havana, the Saratoga, was built by British investors who, in fact, then lost their investment. So the rule of law in Cuba is another issue that the government, you know, if you challenge the government in the courts, you're unlikely to win because the judges, of course, are appointed by the government. So that's an issue. But I agree, on paper, they're pushing for it. And Raul Castro has said he wants to end the false unanimity. He wants to end the sycophantic media in Cuba. And he said those things about 5 years ago. There haven't really been a lot of changes, you could say. But the Obama policy, you know, I think is got wide approval from Americans, not just Cuban Americans. They don't see why they should be prevented from traveling to Havana and Cuba. That's an infringement of U.S. rights.
Luis, what has been your experience of the response to say of Cuban Americans to the fact that even though a lot of them we know now, probably voted for Donald Trump. Were they concerned? Are they concerned?
Well, I mean, the latest statistics I've read on polling is that Donald Trump got about 52% of the Cuban-American vote in southern Florida. And we have to put that in historical context. I mean, 15, 20 years ago, any republic would have gotten 90%
right.
Of the vote. So we see that there's been almost half now in terms of the Cuban-American vote with respect to Donald Trump. However, I don't think that we can say that every Cuban-American that voted for Donald Trump voted because they're in disagreement with Obama's policies. I mean, myself have talked to a lot of Cuban-Americans that voted for Trump, but are not, it's not because they're upset with Obama. It's because maybe they voted for Trump for other reasons, because they didn't like Hillary Clinton or whatever. But because the polling does show exactly what the ambassador says, that the vast majority of Cuban Americans are in favor of moving forward and getting rid of the embargo. And so I don't think that we can take away that he got 52% of the vote, meaning that they're against Obama's policy. Surely, yeah. A number of them are, particularly a lot of the older generation of Cuban Americans in Miami. I am hopeful that there's going to be a lot of other voices coming forth from all the agricultural states, all the companies, all the other Americans and American business interests that really want to move forward with this or continue this policy.
We will continue our conversation about the future of U.S.-Cuban relations. My guest, you just heard from Luis Acalde, Cuban-American attorney based here in Columbus, and also with us, former British ambassador to Cuba, Paul Webster Hare. He's now a lecturer at Boston University. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher, your host. We're talking about the future of U.S.-Cuban relations. President Obama ushered in change last year when he announced that formal diplomatic relations between Cuba and the United States would resume. But President-elect Donald Trump has differed, at least on the campaign trail. Still with us is Columbus-based Cuban-American attorney Luis Acalde, and also by phone senior lecturer in international relations at Boston University and former British ambassador to Cuba, Paul Webster Hare. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8515. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ambassador, White House press, or I'm sure the Cuban government issued a note of congratulations upon Trump's victory in, on Election Day, but was silent on his campaign rhetoric. Is that typical? What happens when he takes office and if he makes good on those promises? So is that Cuban response? Is that a typical Cuban response?
The Cubans are pretty formal in these things, yes. I mean, there's full diplomatic relations, of course, now with the United States, so they have an embassy, and they have a very well-oiled and sophisticated diplomatic service. They are represented in well over 100 countries around the world, and they have some, you know, very professional people. So to send a message of congratulations would be something they would do with every country. I think they would obviously have noted some of the tweets that President-elect Trump sent after the death of Fidel. I mean, that sort of thing they are, of course, very sensitive to. We did a lot with the government, and we also had contacts with the dissidents and so on. But as long as you kind of treated them with the respect of, you know, head of state or government with which you were accredited, they were fine. It wasn't a particularly warm relationship, and I don't think the United States at the moment would classify its own relationship with Cuba as warm. But, that's what diplomats do. They smooth the edges of disputes. They try and find ways to work together and to mutual advantage. So obviously, it's an unknown factor for a lot of countries as to what President-elect Trump will do. And people are waiting eagerly for his nomination, his appointment of the Secretary of State, so we may get more signals in that regard.
And Louis, I mean, a lot of people in Cuba, they don't have access to Twitter, do they? I mean, how much are they really in tune with the way President-elect Trump communicates in this fashion?
Well, his Twitters after the death of Fidel Castro were widely reported in Cuba and were written about. The Cuban government hasn't issued a formal response to those Twitters, but Cuban intellectuals that write in papers like Cuba Debate and Granma and things like that have responded to those Twitters, and you know they were not kind response, that they were not taken as something that he should have been doing, particularly at a time when you know many Cubans felt that they were mourning the death of their revolutionary leader. So I don't think that those Twitters were very productive in terms of going forward. I think the ambassador hit on the word respect, and I think with the Cuban diplomats and the Cuban government, you can have tough discussions if you approach them with respect. After that, you won't have a discussion if you don't approach them with respect. And I think those Twitters are counterproductive, but I'm sure that the Cubans will still wait and see what President Trump actually does.
Mort in Columbus,
yeah.
You're on the air. Hi, Mort.
Hi. Let's go 180 degrees from where we are. And I wonder if anybody would agree with my prediction that within 10 years, the younger Cubans of the island and in Miami, and maybe accelerated by Chinese involvement there, will apply for becoming the 51st state.
Louis Alcalde?
Well, Mort, that's an interesting theory, but I just don't see that happening. Cuba is very, very nationalistic, number one. And so I don't see the Cubans wanting that. And of course, from the United States perspective, I don't know that the United States would be prepared to bring on another state, particularly Cuba, with the history that it has had and the complexities that it's still going to have 10 years from now.
And Ambassador Hare?
Well, I think the Cubans will be getting the message. I think the gentleman who phoned in mentioned China will be getting the message from countries like China and Russia that it's time to get real. You know, it's time to recognize your assets as an island, an economy. You've got hundreds of miles of wonderful beaches. You've got natural resources. You've got virtually a clean slate for most business sectors in Cuba. And it's time to, you know, go for growth and convince the young Cubans on the island, convince the young Cuban Americans maybe to come back or at least live in both places and make this island genuinely prosperous and stop sentimentalizing about, you know, the equality in the good old days of socialism, because that was really only possible because of the Soviet Union and the subsidies and then Venezuela. So that's the issue, and we'll see, you know, what Raul Castro now does. I think if you look at the funeral events of Fidel Castro, mm-hmm. the level of representation was not one might have expected, you know, from China and Russia. They're seeing Cuba as, you know, increasingly maybe less special when they gave them a free pass. So those would be my thoughts on that issue.
Thanks, Mort, for that call. And Joe Moss, of course, a frequent guest on All Sides, counsel for the Ohio Hispanic Coalition. Welcome to the show, Joe.
And good morning. So great hearing you and the ambassador and Luis once again on the air. I do have a question for Luis, if I may go ahead.
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, Luis, you used a term that in a conversation with a Cuban government economist last January, I also heard, and I wanted to get your impression as to what it means. You said that any agreements or, you know, any treaties or contracts with foreign firms in Cuba needed to be, quote-unquote, of benefit to Cuba. And my impression after talking to the economists is that what she was really talking about is that Cuba wanted a majority stock control and a voice in that business. Do you have that same impression, or do you think it's something less than that?
No, I think that the issue of majority control depends on the sectors that of the economy that one is talking about. But for example, in a number of other sectors, Cuba is looking for foreign investment that would be 100% owned by the foreign investor. And one example would be in the energy sector. The Cubans are looking for foreign investors to build solar plants, to build wind plants and those sort of things. And then the foreign investor would get their money out of the project with long-term contracts with the Cuban electrical company. In my own experience with the pharmaceutical deals, they're looking for royalty payments. They're looking for various milestone payments. So the fact that the deal is good for Cuba, I simply mean that I think it's monetarily good for Cuba.
For the economy in general.
Yeah, for the economy in general.
Ambassador, did you want to chime in on that notion?
Well, on the sort of majority holdings, I'm not an expert on this at all, Cuban law. I think the foreign investment law actually provides that for 100% foreign ownership in some cases. But you've got to bear in mind that everything is case by case. Mm-hmm. So every single thing has to be approved on its merits. That's why it takes so long, puts a lot of people off. But they have set out certainly what they're looking for. I think it was $8 billion in foreign investment over a period. And they recently reported that so far, I think they've got under a quarter of that. And they've got this free trade zone in the Mariel port, which is, of course, being built the closest point to the American mainland to do trade with America. So they're anticipating an opening. But the reality still is, needs political momentum. The Communist Party met in April, its last Congress, and, poured cold water on a lot of the reforms. A lot of people were very disappointed. That was a month after President Obama's visit. So the political tea leaves are not necessarily in accord with, what's out there on paper. I think a lot of us, I would agree, would wish them to go much more rapidly because that would help ordinary Cubans to get, better jobs.
Right. There are people in the Cuban government who are older. They're more, quote unquote, conservative in terms of Cuban staying the course of Cuba for the last 50 years. They've been suspicious of the warming relations. Does this change in government to the Trump administration give them a foothold, give them opportunities, Ambassador?
It might do. Yes. If Fidel was not happy, he didn't trust President Obama's motives. I think he said that. And, there is going to be now a tussle between those who say, well, we must expect the worst, or those who say, well, we'll give Mr. Trump a chance to prove what he means. But it's certainly something, there are those people still in the echelons of power. There are a lot of the old fighters still around in the Politburo of the Communist Party. And there are a lot, of course, of sons of Fidel and sons and son-in-laws of Raul, his daughter. So Cuba, even if, Raul were to leave the scene, is not going to become Castro-less. It's there are plenty of them still around to try and guard the legacy, if you like, of Fidel.
And as you've pointed out, Luis, so much still revolves around what the government does, not what individuals do.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, at least 80 to 85% of the economy is in the government's hands. And, I do fear, sort of building on what the ambassador just said, I do fear that a hardline policy from President Trump will play into the hands of those in the Cuban government that are not in favor of these openings.
Joe Mas, thank you so much for calling. Ambassador, President-elect Trump has placed Mauricio Claver Carone, a lobbyist critical of the Obama policies, on the transition team for Treasury, which controls a lot of the regulations affecting U.S. business in Cuba. What do you make of that? I mean, that could have a really powerful impact, couldn't it?
Yes, it could do. But, you know, I think there will be pushback. I think we mentioned earlier in the discussion, 33 of the states now have Republican governors, which I think is the highest total for many years. Mm-hmm. They are the ones who, you know, want to sell their soya beans, which they can do, or their frozen chicken to Cuba. They want to go down and explore ventures which are permitted even under the current state of the embargo. So if this, you know, the gentleman who Mr. Trump's appointed suddenly decides to start clamping down on that or even fining people again for getting into business discussions or making, you know, the people-to-people visits. I think things have moved on, frankly, too much for that to go unchallenged. There's so many different lobbies now. On the question of the Cuban-American vote, I agree with what was said, I think, by Luis, that he won Florida, he won the Cuban-American vote, but not on the Cuba issue. They, of course, are not undocumented, the Cubans who arrived. That's an important point, different from the Latinos. The Latino vote, I think, went very strongly for Hillary Clinton. So they are in a different position. If Donald Trump were to change the wet-foot, dry-foot policy,
yeah,
which, in fact, some Cuban-Americans support because they feel that the real reason for it was political repression and not economic refugees, that would have a major impact in Cuba because the frustrated young people would be, you know, prevented from having that safety valve outlet.
Luis?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that the ambassador is right. I mean, obviously, I was concerned with the appointment, but I have to hope that many other voices that want to continue engaging with Cuba are going to come forward. And I do believe, I think that the ambassador is alluding to something that could be problematic. If all of a sudden, you know, we clamp down in Cuba and there's greater desperation among young people in Cuba and we have a huge exodus either through, through Central America, Mexico or whatever coming here, that's going to do nothing but create problems for the American administration.
Well, Hannah Berkeley Cohen, the freelance reporter for The New York Times that we talked to earlier in the program, said that's already afoot. That's already happening.
Yes. Yes, it is. It is. And I mean, I know Cubans that have come to Miami, even though they had a 5-year visa and could come back and forth between Cuba and the United States, have decided to stay because they were concerned about an ending to the dry foot, wet foot policy.
Huh. Ambassador here, just in parting, can you give us a sense about how, you know, we've talked a lot and we've made allusions a lot to how slow everything moves. Is there something, I mean, but it seemed like it happened really quickly when President Obama announced his intentions back in 2014. Could it take a lot longer to unwind all of this if that's the goal in some people's minds?
Yes, I mean, it could, because a lot of different voices will be brought to bear. I mean, there's a Republican senator now for Arizona, Jeff Flake, who used to come down with Bill Delahunt from Massachusetts, who's a member of the House. So he was a Democrat, bipartisan. He's still in Congress. There are a lot of Republicans who believe that the embargo should be lifted. I think there are others, of course, like Marco Rubio, who are staunch supporters of it. So it's not an easy thing to push one way or the other. The Obama negotiations with Cuba took, you know, a long time. They took at least 18 months in secret, and then Pope Francis played an intermediary role and so on. So it wasn't a quick deal. The Cubans never move quickly. They're always very cautious. So, I mean, I hope that the Trump team will come in with suitably balanced advice. It's a complicated issue, and he'll have to look at the pros and cons of talking tough or essentially wanting to engage.
British Ambassador to Cuba, 2001-2004, Paul Webster here. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Luis Alcalde, Cuban-American attorney based here in Columbus, thanks again for joining us as well.
Thank you, Ann.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.